Schedule information is available at kpfk.org/smalls.
When the revolution comes. Hi, this is Lisa Gay Hamilton, and you're listening to KPFK, 90.7 FM in Los Angeles and 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara.
PFA.org.
Good evening. It's Tuesday, August 25th. I'm Scott Baba. The Trump administration says it won't start targeting Iran's trading partners with sanctions, at least not yet.
Why would I want to blow up the global financial system? We believe that it is important to level set and give people a cure period, but they should know that that will move very quickly and that we are serious.
States, lawmakers, and voting rights advocates scrambled to respond to the Supreme Court's ruling in support of President Trump's proposed restrictions on vote by mail.
The Supreme Court continues to play into what will cause confusion ultimately for voters. And I think it's enormously problematic that the Supreme Court is participating in this way, because they are there to support and protect the U.S. Constitution and the rights that belong to people within it.
And two new laws go into effect in New York State, blocking local law enforcement cooperation with immigration enforcement agents.
ICE can no longer use locally funded police to carry out the Trump administration's aggressive immigration agenda. Local cops cannot be ordered to aid and abet an out-of-control agency with an $85 billion budget.
These stories and more coming up. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, this is the Pacifica Evening News. I'm Scott Baba. Iran and Oman say their top diplomats have met to discuss a phased approach to managing ship traffic through the Strait of Hormuz. A joint statement released by the countries today said their foreign ministers met in Tehran. The critical waterway for oil shipments remains largely shut down nearly 6 months after the U.S. and Israeli went to war with Iran. This comes as U.S. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent announced a new round of sanctions aimed at Iran yesterday and warned every country that does business with the Islamic Republic to sever those financial ties or face retaliation from the United States. Asked why the U.S. was not yet imposing secondary sanctions on Iran's trading partners, Bessent told reporters he wanted countries to have an opportunity to shift away from Iran before it was too late.
Why would I want to blow up the global financial system? We believe that it is important to level set and give people a cure period, but they should know that that will move very quickly and that we are serious.
The Trump administration is struggling to find an off-ramp nearly 6 months into its unpopular war with an increasingly obstinate Iran. Washington had promised new sanctions would put even more pressure on an Iranian economy already battered by previous penalties and a U.S. naval blockade. But this week's announcement provided little detail and did not name which countries could face secondary sanctions. China, Turkey, and the United Arab Emirates are Iran's largest trading partners. Meanwhile, long lines have formed outside gas stations in Iran's capital as people rush to fill their tanks amid fuel shortages, fears of higher prices, and the new U.S. sanctions. Drivers reported waits of 2 hours or more today. Washington's increasing economic pressure in hopes of forcing Iran to make concessions to end the war. Iranian officials accuse the U.S. of trying to foment internal unrest after failing to defeat Iran militarily. Iran's broader economy suffers from double-digit inflation, and its currency has hit a record low. Analysts warn of growing public frustration, though there is no sign yet of protests. Canada has announced a package of tariffs on Made in America products just days after President Donald Trump's tariffs on Canada went into effect. The Canadian tariffs will take effect on September 8th. Canadian officials announced the tariffs in Ontario today, saying they match the U.S. tariffs dollar for dollar. Christopher Martinez reports.
Canada's new tariffs, in response to President Donald Trump's tariffs on Canadian products, mark a major escalation of the trade war. They also mark a breakdown in relations between longtime allies and trade partners. The U.S. is, after all, Canada's largest trading partner, and Canada is the U.S.'s second largest trade partner after Mexico. But after negotiations broke down and Trump announced his tariffs, Canada felt it had no choice. Melanie Joly is Canada's Minister of Industry.
We will not accept a bad deal that asks too much of Canada and offers too little in return. And of course, as Conservative just announced, we will respond to the U.S. tariffs dollar for dollar.
She was speaking in Ottawa with other Canadian officials Tuesday in response to the U.S. tariffs on $28 billion in Canadian goods that were imposed on August 20th.
When the United States of America asked too much and offered too little, we made a choice. We chose Canada.
François-Philippe Champagne is Canada's finance minister. He described the Canadian tariffs as proportionate, targeted, and strategic.
Today I'm announcing that Canada will match the United States tariffs dollar for dollar, rate for rate. Effective September 8, Canada will impose counter tariffs of up to 15, 25, or 50% on 27.6 billion in imports from the United States of America. For each product, our tariff would match the American tariff on the same type of Canadian good.
The tariffs cover some 700 U.S. products, most heavily steel and aluminum, but they range from hockey sticks and maple syrup to appliances, toilet paper, and electronics. The Canadians say the tariffs are meant to protect Canadian businesses and workers from the effects of Trump's tariffs. Industry Minister Joly urged people to buy Canadian.
If you see a Canadian product, please support it. Because what is really important from this new chapter of the trade war is that actually when you choose a Canadian product, you're not only putting pressure on the U.S. Right now, you're protecting jobs. Because the new companies that are affected by the tariffs are actually those that you may see at the grocery store or at your local Canadian Tire. That's what you can do. And that's how we can launch this movement of resistance to what is happening to us.
Canada's Minister of Jobs and Families, Patty Hajou, described Canada's response in terms of labour solidarity.
Canadians know how to navigate storms. They know, just like unions, that by standing up together, sticking up for each other, and finding new paths, we actually can get through anything. And these measures today will serve as the tools for the next part of our fight to build Canada strong.
As part of that standing together, Canada is also providing a $7.5 billion package to support small and medium-sized Canadian businesses affected by the tariffs. The new tariffs, the support for businesses, and the movement of resistance respond, of course, to the Trump tariffs. But to some extent, they also respond to some of President Trump's threats and remarks to make Canada a state, for example, or more recently, Trump's comments about renaming Lake Ontario. But according to Minister Joly, Canada has a tradition of going its own way.
You know why French and English Canadians decided to eventually create that country of Canada? Because we didn't want to be part of the U.S. And so that's part of our DNA. Now, forward 150 years later, we need to make sure that we continue to protect that strong alliance.
The Canadians feel they're in a position of strength, boasting the lowest net debt to GDP of any nation in the G7 and the lowest marginally effective tax rate. Still, Canada and the U.S. are largely intertwined in many ways, and the escalating trade war will hurt businesses and consumers on both sides of the border. But President Trump has said tariff is one of his favorite words, and he's getting ready to launch more tariffs in his campaign targeting countries that trade with Iran. Reporting for Pacifica Radio News KPFA, I'm Christopher Martinez.
Israeli forces raided and seized a United Nations training facility in occupied East Jerusalem today, drawing condemnation from the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees, known as UNRWA. At least four armed vehicles and more than 50 Israeli security personnel entered the Colondia Training Center, forcibly removing roughly 20 UNRWA staff members on site. Five Palestinians were injured by gunfire nearby, according to the Jerusalem Governorate. UNRWA called the raid a, quote, unauthorized and deeply concerning incursion, saying the entry of armed security forces into a United Nations facility without the authorization or consent of the United Nations is unacceptable. The center has served as a vocational training site for Palestinian refugees for more than 70 years. Israeli National Security Minister Itamar Ben-Gvir, who took part in the raid, said, quote, there is no place for the agency in Jerusalem and Israel. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu defended the action as lawful, citing legislation banning UNRWA's activities in Israel. The Palestinian Foreign Ministry called the seizure, quote, a flagrant violation of international law, while a human rights lawyer said it breaches a December 2025 International Court of Justice advisory opinion. Meanwhile, in Gaza City, an Israeli airstrike destroyed a newly opened desalination plant that provided safe drinking water to some 50,000 people. The Israeli military claimed the facility was being used to store weapons, but provided no evidence to support that assertion. Pacifica's Rami Almiari reports from the site of the destruction in Gaza.
In Gaza City's Sheikh Radwan neighborhood, around 50,000 residents have lost access to a critical resource, safe drinking water, after Israeli warplanes struck a new desalination plant on Monday, just five days after it was inaugurated. The strike on the plant was part of a series of Israeli airstrikes following warnings that children in Gaza were prohibited from flying kites. Abdul Hamid Al-Mikawi oversees the plant's plumbing. He told Pacifica that the crews worked for 2 months to bring the facility into operation.
We worked day and night to bring water to the community and to see the happiness on people's faces. But Israel claims the site was being used to store weapons, which is untrue. God is my witness, when we began working here, we had to clear away piles of garbage, rats, and mosquitoes. There were no weapons here. It seems they do not want us to live. Where is the peace they promised? Where is the Board of Peace? Where is Trump, who says he wants peace?
After years of war and destruction, residents expressed sadness over the loss of the plant amid the growing need for clean water across the Gaza Strip, particularly during the summer months. 30-year-old Jihan Al-Nimnim said her community had welcomed the new project as a sign of hope and a source of relief, but its destruction is a stark reminder of the ongoing slaughter.
They tell us lies as the war continues. Look, this is our home. It is now destroyed. We have been displaced multiple times to the south. They should just go ahead and get rid of us. We are completely tired and sick of this. Enough is enough.
About 30 minutes before the plant was struck, the Israeli military ordered people in the surrounding area to evacuate immediately. Local resident Mohammed Shuber lives about 7 feet from the plant.
I was working at a wedding hall when the evacuation order was issued. I became extremely worried about my 5 children, but I could not leave because there was no one to take my place. I could only speak with my family by phone. When I returned home, I found that debris had struck the front wall of the house and turned some of the plastic sheeting.
On Monday, the Israeli military issued evacuation orders for residents in several parts of the Gaza Strip, including 2 mosques, one of them an ancient mosque in the central town of Deir el-Balah. International humanitarian law prohibits attacks on religious and historic sites unless they are being used for military purposes. The Israeli military claimed the holy site was being used by Hamas to store weapons, but provided no evidence to support that assertion. According to Palestinian health officials, at least 8 Palestinians, including a child, were killed in Israeli military operations across the Gaza Strip on Monday. The strikes came amid stalled peace efforts led by U.S. President Donald Trump and his Board of Peace. For Pacifica Radio, KPFA, I am Rami Al-Mirari in Gaza.
The commander of the Kurdish-led Syrian Democratic Forces announced today that the group has officially dissolved, completing a merger with the Syrian army after once controlling a large swath of northeastern Syria. Speaking in Damascus, Commander Malzoum Abdi said the SDF, quote, carried a heavy responsibility during one of the most difficult periods in Syria's history, but that circumstances have changed and the country has entered a new phase. The SDF was once the United States' main partner in the fight against the Islamic State group, but lost most of its territory to a government offensive earlier this year before agreeing to merge with the army. Interim Syrian President Ahmed al-Shara has courted the Kurdish population since taking power, issuing a decree that made Kurdish an official language, adopted the Kurdish holiday of Nowruz nationally, and restored citizenship to tens of thousands of Kurds stripped of it decades ago. Questions remain over issues including the fate of the SDF's all-female combat units, a sensitive point given the conservative background of many Damascus leaders. Meanwhile, the U.S. said this week it removed Syria from its list of state sponsors of terrorism after 47 years, lifting what it said was the final major barriers for private sector investment in the country and its reintegration into the global economy. Armed men killed at least 47 people and kidnapped more than 50 others in an attack near Haiti's capital in what the United Nations calls one of the country's largest mass kidnappings in recent years. Sunday's attack struck Kenskoff, a community in the hills above Port-au-Prince, with at least 22 victims reportedly executed inside a church compound where they had sought shelter. United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres condemned the attack in a statement released by spokesperson Stefan Dujarric.
The relentless attacks on communities and the loss of lives underscore the alarming security conditions in Haiti and reinforce the urgent need to intensify Haitian and international security efforts to counter these ruthless gangs. Secretary General reiterates his call for the Haitian authorities to ensure that those responsible for the attacks are held to account, including through specialized judicial units recently created with international support to investigate mass crimes.
A gang leader identifying himself as Ezo 2 threatened to kill hostages if authorities harm any gang members, warning National Police Director Vladimir Parisin personally in a video, saying, quote, Parisin, if any of our soldiers are hurt, I will kill all of them. Analysts say the attack may be aimed at stretching thin security forces and sending a message ahead of Haiti's December elections. Haiti's National Police say Parisin has ordered an investigation and deployed additional units to the area. Gang violence has displaced a record 1.5 million people across Haiti this year. In Zimbabwe, a government-operated passenger ferry has become the scene of one of the country's deadliest transportation disasters. The vessel capsized on Lake Kariba on August 11th while traveling from the town of Kariba to remote communities and fishing camps. Authorities say 77 people survived, while 94 have been confirmed dead. Search and recovery operations are continuing. KPFA's Girakai Chanza reports from Makdana in South Africa's Eastern Cape as questions mount over why the vessel was carrying so many people and whether the disaster could have been prevented.
For communities scattered along the shores of Lake Kariba, the ferry was more than a passenger boat. It was a vital transport link to Kariba town for people living in remote rural areas where poor roads make access to food, healthcare, government services, and other essentials difficult. But survivors say the journey turned into a disaster after the ferry encountered rough conditions. One passenger says they warned the captain before the boat left.
We had an argument with the captain before the boat left the harbor. We told him that the waves were too strong, but he refused. He said, "Who told you that this is a powerful wave? Are you members of the dam? Have you ever sailed or driven a boat? Please be quiet."
Another survivor says the vessel began losing balance as water poured in and luggage fell overboard.
The boat started dropping luggage into the water because it was beginning to lose balance. I did not see what was really happening as I was seated on the lower deck, but I could hear the commotion. We continued for some meters, and then I saw the captain shouting that we should balance the seating arrangement because the boating was losing balance and water was getting inside. This did not help, as the water was getting inside the boat in large volumes.
Then came a desperate scramble for life jackets.
Amid the chaos, the boat began to sink. We weren't given life jackets, nor were we shown where they stored them. When some passengers realized they were under the seats, people scrambled to reach them, leaving most without one.
The ferry had a passenger limit of 90 people, but authorities later said 114 adults and 5 crew members were recorded as being aboard, along with an unknown number of children who may not have required tickets. Other estimates put the total even higher, with the government later saying the vessel may have been carrying about 180 people, twice its stated capacity. The scale of the disaster is unfolding on one of Africa's most important inland waterways. Lake Kariba was created when the Kariba Dam was built across the Zambezi River between 1956 and 1959. It is the world's largest man-made reservoir by volume and is jointly owned by Zimbabwe and Zambia through the Zambezi River Authority. The dam supplies water to hydropower stations on both sides of the border, making Kariba central to electricity generation and regional economic activity. The lake is also an important center for fishing, tourism, and transport. As the ferry went down, private boat operators were among the first people to respond. Captains Collins Chaparira and Moses Mugande, who work for private cruise companies on Lake Kariba, were among the first to reach the scene. Chaparira says the ferry was already sinking when they arrived, but the disaster has not ended with the search for survivors. In rural Kariba, families are now mourning in a massive scale, with community activists warning of an emerging humanitarian crisis. Community activist Maxton Kanema says food supplies provided to the grieving families have run out.
Another element of a humanitarian side.
There has just emerged another urgent humanitarian crisis in Kariba Rural. There are 53 families that lost their relatives, and the whole village is mourning. While they are mourning, the food hampers that each grieving household receives from the government when collecting death certificates have run out. So we are appealing to the public for help. These people are from rural areas, and they were already poor and vulnerable before this tragedy. In this area, we need a little bit more assistance to cater for the mourners. The situation is deplorable.
The disaster has also triggered a political and legal reckoning. The government has announced an inquest into the circumstances surrounding the sinking, while local government minister Daniel Garry has rejected suggestions that the government should bear responsibility for the disaster. He has instead pointed to alleged negligence and human error by the captain, who was among those who died.
The cabinet has approved that we go ahead and put in place an inquest to start investigations on exactly what took place. Because there are a lot of stories that are being floated through social media, and there are a lot of stories that are being said by people without authority on how this boat and many other boats at Lake Kariba are being managed. The problems that occurred were as a result of negligence and human error by the captain of the boat. It had nothing to do with whether the boat was not fit or was fit. It had a certificate of fitness which was issued by the Minister of Transport through the Rural Infrastructure Development Agency.
But the government's own figures have raised questions about how a vessel licensed to carry just 90 passengers was allowed to operate with so many more people aboard. With 94 people confirmed dead and 77 survivors, the search for additional victims continues as families wait for answers about why the ferry was permitted to sail in dangerous conditions while carrying far more people than it was licensed to hold, and for the communities that depend on Lake Kariba for their livelihoods and basic services. The disaster has exposed not only the dangers of the water, but the consequences when a vital transport lifeline fails. For KPFA Pacifica Radio, this is Garika Ichaunza reporting from Makanda, Eastern Cape in South Africa.
Rohingya refugees took to the streets of Bangladesh today, marking nearly a decade since they were driven from Myanmar and pressing world leaders to make their homeland safe enough to return to. Charles de Ledesma reports.
Tens of thousands of Rohingya refugees in Bangladesh have held rallies on Tuesday to demand safe return to Myanmar. They fled 9 years ago during a government crackdown. The demonstrators are urging the international community to ensure security in Rakhine State. Rohingya refugee leader Syed Ullah tells the AP, "Why should we have to convince anyone to let us return to our country? It's our country. We're not begging anyone, nor are we asking anyone for help. We simply wanted to return there." More than 1 million Rohingya now live in camps around Cox Bazar, Bangladesh. Most fled in 2017 after Myanmar's military launched a crackdown. Bangladesh attempted repatriation twice, but refugees cited security concerns. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
Russian President Vladimir Putin has decreed the state can temporarily take control of critical infrastructure facilities if private owners fail to protect them from Ukrainian drone attacks or don't rebuild after strikes. The decree signed yesterday covers energy, industrial, communications, transportation, and logistics facilities as escalating Ukrainian strikes on oil refineries and e-commerce hubs continue disrupting the Russian economy. Deputy Prime Minister Denis Monturov said the move, quote, doesn't imply the nationalization of companies or change of ownership, but rather targeted state involvement to solve specific security problems. Analysts say the decree is meant to pressure companies to invest in their own defenses. Russian political analyst Abbas Galimov, a former Putin speechwriter, said owners of repeatedly damaged refineries may be reluctant to keep rebuilding, saying, quote, why spend billions if they're going to get hit again tomorrow? Ukraine's military said it struck two more Russian oil refineries overnight, including one hit for the eighth time in a year. CIA Director John Ratcliffe traveled to Moscow today in a rare visit by a United States spy chief, according to people familiar with the matter, as Russia's war in Ukraine grinds through its fifth year. The visit wasn't publicly announced, but flight tracking data showed a United States government transport plane traveling from Joint Base Andrews to Moscow and back over roughly 8.5 hours. The CIA, Pentagon, and White House all declined to comment, and it's unclear what the trip's purpose was. The visit comes amid escalating long-range strikes between Russia and Ukraine, and as the two countries sit on opposite sides of the Iran conflict. Russia has reportedly provided Tehran with intelligence on U.S. military positions in the region. Kremlin spokesperson Dmitry Peskov said Russia had no information about the aircraft and no plans to meet with U.S. officials this week. The last known visit by a CIA director to Moscow was in 2021, when then-director William Burns warned Russian President Vladimir Putin against invading Ukraine, an invasion that began weeks later. The Louisiana National Guard announced this week that it is ending its 8-month deployment patrolling the state's streets of New Orleans. Guard spokesperson Lieutenant Colonel Noel Collins said that 120 remaining troops completed their final patrol yesterday and are set to conclude their mission in the city on August 31st. Last year, 350 troops were deployed to the city to boost public safety in the French Quarter, a year after a deadly attack there killed 14 people. A slimmed-down deployment was later extended. Republican Governor Jeff Landry requested deployment last year, which was authorized by President Donald Trump following other high-profile National Guard missions his administration launched in Democrat-led cities. You're listening to the Pacifica Evening News. It's a one-hour broadcast that airs every weeknights. I'm Scott Baba. We'll be back with more right after this.
A Conversation with Chris Smalls, presented by KPFK 90.7 FM, takes place on Saturday, August 29th from 1 to 3 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church, located at 2936 West 8th Street in Los Angeles. Further information and tickets available at kpfk.org/smalls.
When the revolution comes.
Hi, this is Lonnie Jordan, founding member of the band War, and I'm a big fan of KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles.
U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement arrested nearly 50,000 people during July, the highest single monthly arrest total during the second Trump administration, according to new figures. The spike in immigration arrests shows that the administration has continued to advance its mass deportations agenda despite a shift in approach earlier this year, away from high-profile operations in large American cities that sparked public outcry towards arrests that have garnered less attention but have nonetheless been highly disruptive. The July arrest tally, 49,571, marks a 15% jump from the 43,021 arrests a month earlier and a 70% increase from the 29,241 arrests in February in the aftermath of the Trump administration's enforcement surge in Minnesota. This according to government data that was provided by ICE to the University of California Berkeley's Deportation Data Project and analyzed by the Associated Press. As part of the surging arrest numbers over recent weeks, ICE officers have made arrests at traffic stops. They've increasingly relied on state and local law enforcement partners who are assuming immigration enforcement duties. And they have started to arrest people from Haiti who have seen their protections from deportation stripped away. Meanwhile, two New York laws limiting said cooperation between local police and federal immigration enforcement took effect today, setting up a potential legal fight with several counties that haven't committed to complying. The Local Cops, Local Crimes Act bars local agencies from maintaining agreements that let ICE direct local officers to perform immigration enforcement. New York's Democratic Governor Kathy Hochul said local police can still work with ICE to respond to active crimes, but can't help with civil immigration matters.
ICE can no longer use locally funded police to carry out the Trump administration's aggressive immigration agenda. Local cops cannot be ordered to aid and abet an out-of-control agency with an $85 billion budget. Local cops can no longer be deputized to participate in disorderly raids that too often descend into chaos and violence.
Of 13 counties with such agreements, 11 have agreed to end them. Nassau and Rensselaer counties have not, and the state attorney general's office has issued subpoenas to their law enforcement agencies. Some counties say they plan to fight the law in court. Hochul said the state would respond forcefully.
Any police department or sheriff's office that disobeys this law, that maintains any agreement with ICE, will face legal action. And to those suing us, those trying to block the implementation of this law, tried before and failed. Our law has been already upheld by courts. But if you're trying it again, I say bring it on. Courts have already spoken. But I'm confident we'll win again.
A second law, the Dignity Not Detention Act, bans New York facilities from detaining people for ICE. State Senator Julia Salazar, who sponsored it, said, quote, New York's involvement with immigration detention will finally come to an end. Two unvaccinated Pennsylvania residents have died from measles, the first U.S. deaths this year related to the contagious virus. State health officials announced the deaths today. They did not reveal any details about the people who died, other than to say that they lived in Lancaster County, west of Philadelphia. The United States has now seen 5 measles deaths in the last 2 years, which is more than the combined total of reported deaths over the previous 3 decades. And it's enduring its worst year for measles since 1991. The measles surge has coincided with moves by President Donald Trump's administration to scale back childhood vaccinations based on unverified concerns about vaccine safety. Doctors have raised concerns that Trump and U.S. Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. are stoking confusion and hesitancy over the medicine. Pennsylvania's Democratic Governor Josh Shapiro said he spoke with Kennedy about the situation today.
I was very, very blunt with him, and I made very clear that his actions and the rhetoric that's coming from this administration are having a negative impact on communities across America, particularly right here in Pennsylvania, that there's real-life consequences to spreading misinformation. There's real-life consequences to scaring people.
With 2,777 cases as of today, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, this year has already surpassed 2025 measles count. The deaths come as international health officials plan to meet in November to determine if the United States and Mexico have lost their measles-free status. The U.S. eliminated local measles spread in 2000 by maintaining high vaccination rates, which have fallen in recent years to below the 95% coverage needed to prevent outbreaks. Justice Department lawyers say the John F. Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts could ultimately face demolition unless President Donald Trump's renovation plans are allowed to proceed. In a court filing, Assistant Attorney General Brett Shumate described the center as, quote, structurally unsound, fundamentally unsafe, and embarrassing to the nation's capital, warning it faces, quote, terminal decline without Trump's involvement. It's the first time Trump allies have explicitly raised demolition as a possibility for the more than 50-year-old venue. The filing comes as internal documents obtained by the Washington Post show ticket sales and fundraising plunged after Trump's name was added to the building in December, even as center leaders publicly touted a financial turnaround. Projections showed the center falling nearly $100 million short of its revenue target, with a projected $23 million deficit. A Kennedy Center spokesperson blamed the shortfall on past leadership. Democratic Congresswoman Joyce Beatty of Ohio, a board member not appointed by Trump, is challenging the board's actions in court, arguing leaders prioritize the president's interests over the center's public mission. Palo Alto residents gathered at City Hall for a rally to stop the use of flock cameras amid rising concerns on data misuse and mass surveillance last Thursday.
They are made by Flock. There is one on every block. They capture your features with great ease. And wherever you go, the government will know, cause the cameras are rolling and rolling and rolling. Yes, the cameras are rolling. Say cheese!
Automated license plate readers, or ALPRs, are camera systems that capture photos of every passing vehicle and convert a license plate number into searchable digital text to track a vehicle's movement. The company Flock Safety is one of the major contractors working with local governments to install and oversee these cameras across the country. Palo Alto residents rallied ahead of the city council meeting urging the council to remove the cameras. On the agenda was a proposed independent audit of Flock cameras. Mirza Tariq is with the Council on American Islamic Relations.
Every person here who gets into a car is subject to ALPR surveillance. Every trip, every plate scan, every movement can become part of a searchable record, regardless of whether or not you have committed a crime.
According to Flock Safety's website, their ALPRs can read up to 900 vehicles per minute. An internal audit conducted in the city of Mountain View also revealed that several federal law enforcement agencies have access to Flock camera data in 2024. A nationwide search setting was enabled by the company during this period that allowed the data use. Due to growing criticism of mass surveillance and data misuse, cities like Santa Cruz, El Cerrito, and Mountain View have completely stopped using ALPR cameras. Melissa Dinwiddie, the rally organizer from Indivisible Palo Alto, noted some of the state Flock cameras errors in the state.
Roseville, our neighbor to the north, a false positive rate of 70%. Los Angeles, our neighbor to the south, an error rate of 30%. In Oakland, our neighbor to the east, a woman was pulled over because her plates were swapped onto a car of a completely different color.
There are numerous other cases of ALPR errors and misuse nationwide. According to reports from the Institute for Justice, a sheriff's deputy used 83,000 ALPRs in Texas to find a woman who had allegedly had a medical abortion. Palo Alto City Council member Julie Lycott-Hames also participated in the rally.
Real safety ensures that everyone can access critical services without the fear of being kidnapped or worse. We urge Palo Alto to follow the leadership of cities like Mountain View, East Palo Alto, Santa Cruz, El Cerrito, and more.
I'm really proud of the residents of our city for standing up and saying enough is enough. We're living in an authoritarian regime, and everybody here knows it. And the Flock cameras are tiny little omnipresent reminders of what's happening at the federal level.
As the rally came to a close, onlookers were handed out free popsicles. Some wore cardboard cutout heads that resembled Flock cameras, along with red gowns inspired by the dystopian novel The Handmaid's Tale. Tariq from CARE on public safety.
Real safety ensures that everyone can access critical services without the fear of being kidnapped or worse. We urge Palo Alto to follow the leadership of cities like Mountain View, East Palo Alto, Santa Cruz, El Cerrito, and more to get the Flock out of Palo Alto.
Cities like San Jose face federal and state-level lawsuits for funneling ALPR data to out-of-state agencies and for violating Fourth Amendment rights to the residents. Brian Hofer from Secure Justice, a civil rights and privacy group, spoke at the rally.
Over the next few months, your local city council members and county supervisors, your state assembly members and senators are going to ask you for money, for your endorsement, for your vote in November. Make their position on the surveillance state an election issue.
Meanwhile, Get the Flock Out, a slogan targeting the ALPR company Flock, has echoed across the country as opposition to artificial intelligence-powered surveillance draws support across the political spectrum. In the Bay Area, a demonstration kicked off another week of protests. Vinay Ranganathan reports.
Activists from Sunrise Movement's Bay Area chapter focused on climate action and nonviolent protest sat outside a crypto billionaire's home in San Francisco this weekend. Chris Larson is the latest target because of his recent funding of a $9 million grant for the San Francisco Police Department's Real-Time Investigation Center. The center includes Flock automated license plate readers and other so-called live view technologies. Supporters say the mass surveillance is a tool that assists officers and lowers crime, but critics say the funding expands police surveillance across the city. They argue that the technology doesn't make people safer.
There is not much evidence that Flock cameras and surveillance systems in general significantly impact crime rates.
That was Luke Bouchard, a Sunrise Movement organizer who spoke with ABC7 News Bay Area. They called it a billionaire watch party, with organizers and protesters holding megaphones while chanting, criticizing Larson's wealth and funding of surveillance technologies.
Our futures matter, and you're building a dystopian society, and you need to f***ing stop.
But supporters and police are pushing back on these claims, saying these cameras are necessary to public safety and important for finding missing people and vehicles. Protesters, however, have the opposite view and see Flock cameras as an invasion of privacy that has been riddled with officer abuse, wrongful arrests, and so-called side door access by federal agencies like ICE to collect data. This protest has kicked off a week of national action, sparked by DeFlock, a coalition of organizations with the purpose of raising awareness about the use of these cameras. The Oakland Committee for Human Rights in the Philippines says it has heard the call and is holding an event to discuss ties between the Bay Area and other international communities who are also impacted. The organization's chair, Alex, who only shared the first name, says ALPR technology, specifically Flock, is not being used for the best interest of people.
And we see it being used for corporations to profit off of increased surveillance, increased oppression of vulnerable communities such as migrants. You know, it's a really big issue that a lot of people are really outraged about, is the use of these surveillance technologies to target and detain migrants and other vulnerable communities, when we really could be using the tech development to solve other problems that people are facing and help make our lives better.
The group says this isn't just a domestic issue, arguing this impacts communities across the globe.
These surveillance technologies are being developed not only for use of solving crimes here, but they're really an instrumental part in the advancement of war abroad. And in that, we see the committing of human rights violations in places like the Philippines, which is what my organization focuses on. And so the response would be, are the technologies that are being used for human rights violations and war crimes in other parts of the globe, are those really what's going to make us safer here in the Bay Area?
Alex says there is a through line between international communities, connecting the ties between organizations that rely on what Oakland CHRP argues are industries dependent on exploitative systems, from the extraction of minerals used to build technology to the displacement of communities for data centers and the use of low-wage labor in the Philippines. As part of the Community Week of Action today, CHRP has an event Tuesday, August 25th, calling for the abolition of tech for surveillance and war.
So tonight we're hosting a teach-in as a part of the National Week of Action Against Automated License Plate Readers, just to kind of expand on some of these connections that I mentioned. Between the surveillance technology that people are really taking a stand against here and the impacts that that has on people in the Philippines, and also what we can do to really strengthen those connections of solidarity.
Alex also said there is a U.S.-led initiative called Pax Silica with Israel and the Philippines, excluding China to control the supply chain for AI and tech development while heightening tensions with them. Alex emphasized the use of surveillance and drones in Gaza, especially with the Philippines' Toboso 19 incident, which ended up leaving 9 civilians dead. The group says it's focusing on no tech for surveillance and war, scheduling more events and teachings to advance their message of solidarity and activism against war and mass surveillance. For KPFA News, I'm Vinay Ranganathan.
California is one of only 3 states that sets no minimum age for marriage. Advocates for legislation to raise the Minimum Marriage Act to 18 say it's long past time for the state to protect the rights of teenage girls who are coerced into marriage by their parents. Eileen Alfandari reports.
Christina Sutton was 16 when she says a nearly 22-year-old man began a sexual relationship with her hours after meeting her and then married her within months. She says her parents knew she didn't want to get married, but coached her about what to say when she appeared before a judge who had to approve the marriage.
I remember sitting in a judge's chambers in Napa being asked point blank, "Are you being forced to do this?" Like most abused children, I chose lying to a judge over risking escalation at home. I repeated exactly what my parents had coached me to say. I am very mature for my age. I am choosing this. I carried that revictimization for years, believing that by speaking those words, I had somehow chosen what I was forced into. The failure of every adult around me is appalling.
According to a report by the group Unchained at Last, nearly 300,000 minors under the age of 18 were legally married in the U.S. between the years 2000 and 2018. More than 23,000 California girls were among them. The group says that nationally, a few girls were as young as 10, although nearly all were 16 or 17. Most were married to adult men an average of 4 years older. In California, minors need parental and judicial consent to marry. A group of San Jose Girl Scouts testified in favor of the legislation to raise the minimum marriage age to 18. Among them was 14-year-old Sophia.
I am a first-generation Pakistani, and many of my family members from Pakistan, such as my aunts, cousins, and grandmothers, have experienced forced child marriage. They felt like their freedoms were stolen and that they were trapped. I don't want this to happen to any other child again.
Only California, New Mexico, and Mississippi have no minimum marriage age, but nearly every state allows minors to marry under certain conditions. If California raises the required marriage age to 18, it would be among a handful of states to do so. ACLU California Action opposes the legislation, writing that, quote, marriage can provide critical legal protection for pregnant minors and young parents, including emancipation, the right to consent to their own medical care, and access to spousal benefits unavailable to unmarried partners. The ACLU also argues that parents who coerce their children into relationships may not be deterred by a ban on legal marriage. But the bill's author, Democrat Gail Pellerin, said the consequences of early marriage, which overwhelmingly affects girls, are dire.
Research has shown that women who marry as children face lifelong consequences, including limited educational opportunities, lower economic mobility, and greater risk for violence and unwanted pregnancies. Many organizations, including Human Rights Watch and the U.S. State Department, consider marriage before 18 to be a human rights abuse and a form of child abuse.
The Assembly Judiciary Committee unanimously approved the bill, which must clear the full legislature before the session ends on August 31st. I'm Eileen Alfandari for KPFA News.
The California Supreme Court is weighing 2 legal challenges to Riverside County Sheriff Chad Bianco's seizure of more than 650,000 ballots from last year's special election. One was brought by the UCLA Voting Rights Project on behalf of Riverside County voters. The other was filed by California Attorney General Rob Bonta. Both argue Bianco exceeded his legal authority. Teresa Wersbianska has more.
The case was before the court Monday in San Francisco, where justices appeared skeptical of Riverside Sheriff Chad Bianco's argument that a sheriff can use a criminal investigation warrant to take custody of election ballots. The ballots were seized in March after a local citizens group alleged that the November 2025 election on California's redistricting measure had been improperly counted. Riverside County election officials have said the allegations were based on a misunderstanding of preliminary vote counting data. Bianco's deputies nevertheless seized roughly 1,000 boxes of ballots and election materials. After Monday's arguments, Chad Dunn of the UCLA Voting Rights Project, which represents Riverside voters challenging the seizure, said the case goes well beyond Riverside County.
And what happened here today doesn't just spread throughout Riverside County. It won't just spread around 57 counties in the state of California, but instead it's going to send a message around the country that our election ballots are the voters' ballots to be protected at all costs. And a registrar of voters has a duty and responsibility to make sure that they're not removed from their custody and handled in any way that doesn't comply with the process that the legislature prescribed.
Dunn told reporters he was pleased with how the justices responded to the case, but Bianco remains defiant. His attorney argued that the sheriff obtained valid search warrants and that nothing in California law prevents law enforcement from taking ballots when they're potentially evidence in a criminal investigation. Speaking outside the courthouse, Bianco said the issue is whether law enforcement can investigate allegations of election crimes.
How strange that now we have evidence that the machines counted something different than the ballots that we have, and an attorney general runs in to stop that investigation so we'll never know.
Bianco has also argued that the ballots are evidence and that he intends to continue pursuing the investigation. Former California Attorney General Javier Becerra, now a senior advisor to the UCLA Voting Rights Project and gubernatorial candidate, spoke at the courthouse after the arguments.
As we've seen over the last few years, elections are under attack. Voting rights are under attack throughout this country and including in California. And we need to stand up.
Becerra called for a quick decision from the court, saying the dispute has consequences for public confidence in elections. The California Supreme Court is expected to issue its ruling in the coming months. For Pacifica Radio, KPFA, I'm Teresa Wersbianska.
Global icon and humanitarian Dolly Parton, known around the world as a beloved singer, songwriter, actor, author, and philanthropist, has died at the age of 80. Her nephew, Brian Seaver, announced her death on Parton's social media accounts this afternoon.
This video announcement is something Dolly asked of me years ago, before I fully absorbed it as a future reality. As her head of security for more than two decades, a role my father Larry held before me, I have imagined the heaviness of this moment, but haven't truly felt it until now. It is an honor that is mixed with absolute pride and great sadness. But sadness lies with us, not with Dolly. Dolly has lived in the light.
According to her publicist, Parton died peacefully in Nashville following a brief battle with cancer. Her death prompted a rare bipartisan outpouring of grief, with tributes coming from drag queens to President Donald Trump, who ordered flags lowered to half staff through September in recognition of Parton's contributions as one of America's greatest artists. Her charm, humor, and poignant songwriting made her a beloved figure across generations and political divides. Parton was a devoted philanthropist. Her father, Robert Lee Parton Sr., could not read or write after leaving school to support his family. She said his experience inspired her to establish the Dolly Parton Imagination Library in 1995. To date, it has distributed more than 325 million free books worldwide, and now mails more than 3.5 million books each month to children under five. In May, Parton canceled a planned Las Vegas residency, sharing the announcement on social media.
Well, hey there, it's Dolly, and I'm here to give you an update on a few things going on in my life. First, it's concerning my health.
She would later reveal that she had been struggling with kidney stones, but in classic Dolly fashion, shared the news with humor and cheer.
But you know, I've told you before that I've always had problems with my kidney stones. Lord, they dig more stones out of me a year than the rock quarry in Rockwood, Tennessee.
A short obituary released by her family described her as, quote, a rhinestone life that shone bright enough for the world to see, close quote. At Parton's request, a small private service will be held for her immediate family. In lieu of flowers, her family is asking
a conversation
to
with Chris Smalls, presented by KPFK 90.7 FM, takes place on Saturday, August 29th from 1 to 3 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church, located at 2936 West 8th Street in Los Angeles. Further information and tickets available at kpfk.org/smalls.
When the revolution comes.